Imagine an affluent community. Newly built subdivisions with names like Ivy Bluff, filled with impressive houses built in the latest design, with three-car garages and green manicured lawns. The schools are some of the best in the state, with the kids going on to Ivy Leagues, following the careers of their parents, who now work long hours to keep their children decked out in the clothes the social scene demands. This community is over 90% white. The poorer whites and the town's few blacks and Latinos staff the fast food restaurants and the chain stores where the kids go with their parents' credit cards. There's very little crime in this community. Everyone knows each other. Everything seems stable and in control. Imagine in this same community a syphilis outbreak affecting over 200 teenagers, some as young as 12 and 13. Imagine cherubic, sweet-faced, middle-class white girls with 20, 40, or 100 sex partners. Imagine being a parent in the Ivy Bluff subdivision and hearing that your 13-year-old girl contracted syphilis at group sex parties, sometimes on the edge of town with a group of African-American boys, mixed-race kids, and homeless youth. In 1996, in Conyers, Georgia, a syphilis outbreak among teenagers was reported to the Georgia Division of Public Health. The outbreak was spread by a highly sexual group of 15 young, affluent white girls. The journalists who investigated it remarked, "We were struck by how widespread the kind of unrest and loneliness and hunger for structure and experimentation was among kids all over the community." One of the journalists described the girls as what I would call sweethearts. They had soft faces, soft expressions, soft voices, shy smiles. You had this tension between the way they looked and the kinds of things that had been happening in their lives. That comment could also be made of me when I was a teenager. I lived here in Midland and attended Trinity School. I was the model student and daughter. I got straight A's, won all the awards for character and achievements, played varsity sports, did community service. It all looked just right on the surface, as far as most could tell. But it wasn't the whole truth. Most of my friends knew differently. That perhaps when I spent the night at their house, I would sneak out, even if they wouldn't come with me, to walk many dark city blocks, to sneak into the house of a boy I hardly knew and would never see again. That I'd be willing to bring tequila into the school in a contact lens solution bottle and drink it with my friends in the bathroom before chapel. This continued, and soon I felt quite like Jekyll and Hyde. Dark, starkly divided from light, good from bad. This continued into college. Alcohol helped tremendously, as blackouts meant I didn't even have to remember the shadow sides that emerged. So what was the deal? Did I and these girls in Georgia just need better parenting, more abstinence education, more structure, more consequences? Even then, as a teenager, I intuitively felt somehow that my rebellion was about something deeper. Thankfully, my mom knew too, and although she couldn't completely rescue me at the time, she planted the seeds that eventually helped me heal. For one, she listened. And she gave me Naomi Wolf's book, Promiscuities: The Secret Struggle for Womanhood. Wolf points out that female adolescence is often a time of fanaticism that can display itself in obsession with horses, for example, the rigors of eating disorders, body piercing, strict vegetarianism, shoplifting, or mystical conversions. Naomi Wolf says, "What were we doing with these ritualistic behaviors and obsessions? At any given time, our fanaticisms had a perfect internal logic. All of us were, in our different ways, trying to create tests for ourselves so we could know we were graduating the stages into womanhood." See, our culture doesn't have meaningful rites of initiation for teenagers going into adulthood. So they try to engineer their own rites, most of the times hurting themselves in the process. Teens rebel, I think, because somewhere unconsciously, they understand that the adults, perhaps unconsciously, are not telling them the whole truth, are not giving them what they need to live in a complex and messy world. When I heard the story of those girls in Georgia, what was immensely compelling to me was the variety of boundaries they transgressed. These girls broke not only their community's norm around premarital sex, but also transgressed even more powerful norms around race and class. In their strikingly homogenous community, these sweet girls crossed the tracks and associated with the marginalized, homeless, African American, and mixed race youth. This was not simple misbehavior, but I'd argue a forceful, probably unconscious, but forceful statement about their whitewashed culture. The sociologist Peter Berger describes society as interlocking systems that constantly enforce the status quo, carving out a structure of apparent stability by pushing away the dark and the messy. Think of such popular films as American Beauty, or American Psycho, or The Stepford Wives, or Pleasantville. As Berger says, this is the bright day side of life, tenuously held onto against the sinister shadows of the night. The marginalized and the misfits in our society end up serving for us as a walking manifestation of the underground we have tried to repress. Perhaps the infamous midlife crisis emerges from the need to reckon with the desires and alternate identities we've kept below the surface in order to succeed and fit in. The descent into darkness is in some ways a dissent against our anesthetized culture. In her memoir, The Words to Say It, Marie Cardinal struggles with her own depression as well as the memory of her mother's depression. And she explains the difference between their two experiences, saying, "If I had not become insane, I would never have emerged. As for my mother, she forced back her insanity until the end. It was too late. She was afraid to rebel through the words and the gestures of rebellion. She didn't know them. They had never taught them to her." In our culture, unfortunately, we typically silence voices of dissent, whether those voices come from those who are different or even from our own shadow sides. We stubbornly try to hold it at bay, difference, trauma, or just the inherent complexity of life. The power dynamics of our culture are rooted in that suppression. So to live fuller lives, we have to disrupt those narratives we have taken as given and courageously unearth perspective, desires, and thoughts from which we have estranged ourselves. Because they are dangerous only because they are repressed. Wisdom stories from many traditions indicate that in order to find these lives of abundance and blessing, we must wander through the desert, wrestle in the wilderness, or descend to the underworld. One of my favorite myths about descending to the underworld is a story 4,000 years old about the Sumerian goddess Inanna. The story goes like this. Inanna, queen of heaven, abandons her realms to visit her sister Ereshkigal, queen of the underworld. This is why Scott and Sonia chose Doppelganger as their selection this morning. This dualistic world feels like my high school, where we had to navigate the no-win dichotomies of prude, slut, goody-goody, slacker, prep, geek, Inanna, Ereshkigal. So how does Inanna's descent to her dark sister help her become more whole? Well, she probably gets off on the wrong foot. She prepares herself by gathering about her what the text calls the seven me. They leave it untranslated. They're objects of ornamentation and protection. She also, and this is good, gives orders to her faithful servant to set up a lament if she does not return from the underworld. As she descends, she must pass through seven gatekeepers who each make her remove a piece of her me, her crown, bracelets, staff. Each time, Inanna asks, "What is this?" Each time, the response is, "Quiet, Inanna. The ways of the underworld are perfect. They may not be questioned." Eventually, she must enter the underworld completely naked. The text says, "Naked and bowed low, Inanna entered the throne room. Ereshkigal rose from her throne. Inanna started toward the throne. The judges of the underworld surrounded her. They passed judgment against her. Ereshkigal fastened on Inanna the eye of death. She struck her. Inanna was turned into a corpse, a piece of rotting meat, and was hung from a hook on the wall." Of course, this is what we fear will happen in the darkness. We fear that if we open up to difference, to loss, to the unknown, we'll be destroyed. But let's see what happens next in the story. Above ground, Inanna's faithful servant has noticed something is awry. The servant goes to the patriarchal figures of heaven and earth, asking for help to save Inanna. They each say no, protesting. Inanna craved the great below. She who goes to the dark city stays there. That sound familiar? Sounds like our own internal monologues. I got what was coming to me, I should have known. Or the external voices, she was asking for it. It's his fault, it's not our concern. But then her servant visits the god of wisdom. In great contrast, the god of wisdom responds very empathically and then does an odd thing. He fashions from the dirt under his fingernail two tiny, seemingly insignificant creatures. And to them he says, "Go to the underworld, enter the door like flies. Ereshkigal, the queen of the underworld, is moaning with the cries of a woman about to give birth. When she cries, 'Oh, oh, my inside,' cry also, 'Oh, oh, my inside.' When she cries, 'Oh, oh, my outside,' cry also, 'Oh, oh, your outside.'" So they do as the god of wisdom says, sliding under the door and past the gatekeepers right up to Ereshkigal's side. Remember, Inanna right now is a corpse hanging on the hook. Although Ereshkigal does not acknowledge these two tiny creatures, they cry with her as she moans for her insides, her outsides, her belly, her back, her heart, her liver. She's really having a hard time. They patiently mirror her pain. Finally, Ereshkigal looks up and asks in surprise, "Who are you, moaning and groaning and sighing with me?" She is so pleased, she offers them gifts of rivers and fields in harvest, but they do not accept them, asking only for the corpse of Inanna, which Eresh Kigal finally releases. They sprinkle the food of water and life, and Inanna arises. She returns above ground, and our part of the story ends. So, two tiny, seemingly inconsequential creatures redeemed this awful scene in the underworld. All the creatures did was witness and mirror the queen of the underworld's pain. When we are face to face with the shadow sides of our neighbors, when we cross the tracks, when we fall into the darker parts of ourselves and our lives, I believe that only compassion transforms. Only compassion transforms. Only patient witnessing of what is will lead us into fuller living, where the darkness ceases to be something to fear. So I urge us, as we in this church cultivate this oasis of a community, let it not be that bright dayside tenuously held onto against the night. Let us remember not to spurn the darkness, whether that darkness be difference among us or shadows within us. The African teacher Maladoma Somé says, "It is the absence of radical and genuine recognition that makes suffering grow larger." So let us open in compassion and be a radical witness to all that is. So may it be. Blessed be.